This week on the Lunch Podcast, we're talking with Jeremy Saulnier and Macon Blair of a Radius TWC release, Blue Ruin, in theaters April 25th. Don't forget, the Lunch is brought to you by Snoot Films, maker of quality independent entertainments like Cheap Thrills and the upcoming The Guest. Hi, I'm James Rocky, your regular host, and you're listening to The Lunch Podcast, a podcast about film and occasionally food, where I talk with creators and critics in the world of the cinema. This week, with no time for a meal beforehand, it's still very much my pleasure to have as my guests Mr. Jeremy Saulnier and Mr. Macon Blair of the film Blue Ruin. Mr. Saulnier is a director, cinematographer, and writer. Mr. Blair plays its lead character, Dwight, on a very different journey of revenge than anything you've seen before. The film will be released on the 25th in New York, Los Angeles, and Austin by Radius TWC Releasing, and you can find it on Twitter at Blue Ruin Movie. Gentlemen, thank you very kindly for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Jeremy, let's start with you, and also so people can better identify your voice, of course, but you two had worked on Murder Party, which from its very title implies a certain degree of frivolity and bloodshed.
Absolutely.
And yeah. Blue Ruin works superlatively as a much darker, much more plot-driven film. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's not without a sense of humor. I'm really curious about, for you as a writer, where the whole Blue Ruin idea came from.
Blue Ruin was formed at this crossroads where, you know, a bunch of us grew up in Alexandria, Virginia, making movies together as elementary school students. And we loved John Carpenter films, early Peter Jackson movies. So Murder Party was more akin to what we were used to doing growing up, which is like Monty Python style, over-the-top gore,
heightened
splatter.
Hilarious genre.
Absolutely. And, you know, but after many attempts to break into the industry, we did a short film in 2004 called Crab Walk, which was more of a melancholy kind of indie, very 90s movie. But it did well for us. We did festivals. But anyways, Blue Ruin was after a six-year hiatus from feature filmmaking. We didn't make those inroads we needed to. We didn't take off. Our careers were kind of stalled out. And it was a great opportunity for us to reassess what we were doing, to embrace our limitations, and also overextend ourselves as far as let's get out of our comfort zone of self-parody and laughs and splatter for splatter's sake and make a genre movie, not shed our youth entirely, but ground it in reality and have this stark emotional journey that drove it. And also, it was very practically made for a vehicle for my good buddy Macon Blair right here, because he had stepped aside for Murder Party, and our good friend Chris Sharp took the lead for that film. But Macon's been like our favorite actor as a collective since the 80s, and it was like a 20-year journey to get him as a lead role in front of the camera.
Macon, I'll say that when we first meet Dwight, and it's completely silent, which I adore, and we'll talk about that later, but early on, he's just relaxing in a home, and then it transpires that it's somebody else's home as you beat feet through the window. And I mean, a lot of the time, a revenge thriller is about, you know, the one-man army, the ex-cop they pushed too far. They didn't know he was a Marine when they killed his family.
Exactly.
And the great thing in Blue Ruin is that while Dwight has a set of highly specialized skills, they're really more about cunning and silence and exile and survival.
Yeah, and fishing and stuff
and
like
fishing
that. Yeah.
And just, you know, rote Maslow's needs. Where am I going to sleep? Where am I going to hide my car battery? And, I mean, did the decision to have Dwight be that shattered, how early on did that decision come in terms of the process when you were looking at Mr. Saulnier's script? Did you feel competent to convey just how far off the tracks Dwight has been knocked?
That's a great question. I was definitely hesitant, and in some ways I even tried to, like an idiot, talk Jeremy out of casting me early on in this process, because it was so far afield from the types of things that I'd done before, and I didn't want the responsibility of blowing this movie that he's invested all of his family's money in. But we talked about it, and that sort of lack of skills that you just talked about became the very centerpiece of this guy. He is, in fact, in the wrong movie. He belongs somewhere else, and he's been thrust into the middle of this very pulpy B movie type of scenario. That you're right. He's not a vet. He's not a skilled assassin or anything like that. And that's kind of the take on it, is watching him try and complete this mission nonetheless. And hopefully that's funny in places, and hopefully it's real, and hopefully if people do respond to the movie, that may be why.
I also love the whole scene when Dwight's meeting with his sister, you know, and he's looking lightly more presentable and what have you, and at one point he says, I'm sorry, I just have not talked to another human being.
I'm not used to talking.
Yeah, this much. Like, one of my favorite quotes from Steven Soderbergh is that silence is one of the things that the movies can do that TV can't. You know, the whole idea of silence is a building block of cinema. When you're making a film that has so little dialogue and what you do have matters so much, is it a bit unnerving? Do you have to trust yourself that this long, quiet scene people will watch because it's still motivated by character, plotting, thematics, everything you want, just without the jibber-jabber?
Absolutely. I mean, I think in development process, or if you're sharing the script with financiers, you will get those notes. Like, we need more exposition. I was told to start the movie on Dwight's parents being shot up back in, like, 1997, like, to justify this act of violence that Dwight does to carry out revenge. But it was all about, you know, knowing, well, you know, let's embrace the fact that we have no distribution, we have no, like, financiers in place. We can at least tell a pure vision and explore the spaces that other films will chop out. Like, it's not about narrative convenience or perfect jigsaw sort of puzzle, you know, structure. It's about
my head 20 degrees to the left, and the whole plot unfolded its secrets to me.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. It's we make it very hard for Dwight to fulfill his mission. And when he does, abruptly early on in the first act, it's a left turn that we don't see coming. And then we, if you want to cut that out for spoilers, I don't know. But and then we explore the aftermath.
This the film, ramifications.
Exactly. The blowback, the complications. And I always say this, but it's true. Like, getting groceries in New York City is harder than committing murder in the cinematic space. It's always devoid of, like, the logistics and the things that pop up in reality and in ill-timed events that make things real. And so it was fun to explore that space.
Also, the Austin Powers thing, I always get a kick out of that.
Which is...
I was watching Austin Powers, and there's a scene where it's a you know, goofy parody of 60s action movies, James Bond. But there's a scene where a henchman gets killed in a big spectacle scene. But the film comes to an abrupt halt.
Oh my God, he's dead!
And there's a housewife, you know, back in suburbia, and she gets a call on the phone, and she picks it up, and she's informed that her henchman husband was killed at work. And it was brilliant, because you never see that. How many times have you seen the body counts mount? Hundreds of people die in certain scenes, but there's never any consequence explored.
Those dudes have families.
They have families. And I wanted to do that with this movie, is like, explore those complications in real-world scenarios that would pop up if one were to indulge upon this very standard revenge mission. What would happen afterwards? Would the credits roll, or would the world keep spinning and you'd be left having to deal with it? And Dwight tries to sort of undo what he did and fails miserably.
I was talking recently on this podcast with Allison Wilmore, the new critic for BuzzFeed, who's worked for IndieWire, and we joked that our dream version of Avengers 2 has 20 minutes of people complaining about their 401k. You know, like the stuff in between. There's also the whole thing, and Mr. Blair, I thought about this when I saw the film at Sundance, and in my review at cinephile.com explained this, that there's a great quote from Alfred Hitchcock, which is that most people have no idea what hard work it is to kill a man.
Yes.
Was it, like, convey? Because you have some action scenes in this that look exhausting, arduous, sweaty, uncomfortable. It helps a film be great, but at the end of those, were you just wiped out, you know, like clapping your co-star on the shoulder? Great morning, you're pretending to kill you, but I think I pulled my shoulder.
Exactly. In fact, the guy that I killed in the bathroom is a good friend of ours, Sandy Barnett, who was one of those guys that we grew up with in Virginia making movies together, and he and I always for whatever reason, end up getting put in these scenes in the movies that Jeremy and other guys would make, just beating the shit out of each other. And that was kind of why he was cast, was because that part called for one thing, which is to have this disastrous fight scene in a bathroom. And so we got Sandy in there and just did that. And in fact, what was shot was a much more protracted. He was like throwing me through the stall door and into the sink and everything like that. And he gets so into it that he was actually closing off my wind. And I had to keep reminding him, like, we absolutely can just pretend this. You don't need to literally choke me to
There's
death.
There's no such thing as method strangling, sir.
Yes, thank you. And I had to remind him of that repeatedly. But yeah, that was that was kind of what was fun about it, was going back to this very familiar ground of just doing the same sorts of things that we had done growing up, but with a greater story surrounding it, and better production value.
Well, it's also, I mean, one of my favorite fight scenes of all time is in From Russia with Love, where it's just
Robert Shaw
in a train compartment.
Totally.
And they don't,
brutal.
Like, pull a wall out from it or anything. No. These two very large men in a small room beating the bejabers out of each other. Was that why you chose bathroom, not parking lot under a blood red moon, not down by the bayou where the
Absolutely.
Cypress moss hangs from the trees?
It worked out perfectly. It was a very supposed to be by design a contained space, and sort of this back room exchange that was peripheral to a celebration. And for me, it was this highway bar, and things just kind of line up for Dwight in this part of the film, where he's surprised at how easy it is for him at this moment to sort of sneak in and
conduct his business,
and be lying in wait in the bathroom stall. And we just couldn't afford to build sets, so we were in a tough situation where we couldn't find the location. Things weren't lining up. But on the way out of a location scout in Virginia, we happened upon this highway bar, and it blocked out perfectly for the scene, give or take one cheat for how they enter from the exterior. But I loved it because also, it's so fun as an indie filmmaker to have limitations imposed upon you, because it gives you boundaries. And if you know your boundaries, then you know how to act. And it was like, we're going to go handheld. It's right for the scene, but also we can't fit tripods in here or dollies or sliders. So it was great. We embraced this tight location and used it, I think, and it helped performance and helped it feel really contained. And again, you know, having Sandy Barnett and Macon Blair, we were doing these fight scenes since the late 80s or early 90s, and it was about using all of our resources that were available and knowing, hey, if this is about these two guys fighting, I know just the guys, and they're not SAG actors I'm going to cast with stunt coordinators. It's just my buddies from grade school.
Who also have been beating each other since the Reagan era, roughly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. The beard. The beard has been a big part of a promotion. They had a longest beard competition, I believe.
They did. There's another one coming up.
Another one coming up. But how long did you grow that GD thing? Because that is a great chin slinky, man. That is majestic.
Chin slinky. 9 months. 9 months, yeah.
Was it just you, or did other people suffer for your art? Like, do you have a significant other who was tired of being smooched by a badger, or what?
My wife, Lee, was very supportive. She was fine with the way the beard looked. She, I think, got a little tired of me bitching and moaning about the beard, that it was itchy and it was hot and it smelled like milk and whatever else. But no, she was glad that it was gone so that I could shut up about it, not that it was gone in and of itself.
Right. She did not miss a beard. She missed you complaining about the
Precisely
beard.
Precisely right.
When there's that whole thing, I mean, mid-film, all of a sudden Dwight shows up clean-shaven, haircut slightly more bright-eyed, in a rockin' pair of Dockers.
Yeah.
Was the transformation in a suburban Dwight as shocking to you as it was, you know, to a viewer of the film? Were you looking at the mirror for a bit going, who's this nerd?
I don't know if it was shocking, but we had a little party in Jeremy's hotel room that night when it was time to shave it off, and it was sort of like in Johnny Handsome when he takes the bandages off and he looks at his doctors and he's like, oh my god.
Yeah.
So that was it was fun for it to come off, but hopefully, I mean, the intention was always for that sort of reveal to be kind of a surprising moment for the audience, because it kind of mirrors the first time you see Dwight, and you think it's going to be that same sort of a setup and payoff, and then hopefully it's surprising when you see this new version of him where he's kind of
I mean, I Macon doesn't usually rock a beard, but he had to for this role. So it was a 9-month process for him to grow this beard before production. And so I knew, of course, Macon pre-beard, but the crew didn't know him pre-beard. So they just were, they met him on set.
Double takes over at craft service
when
after
he happened. When he shaved the beard, he walked through set and he was not recognized by half the crew.
I went by the, Cameron and Steven, two of the crew guys. And that morning I walked by and I said, hello. And they looked at me and kept on walking. And I was like, what a couple of pricks. I'm just trying to be friends. And then I realized they literally thought I was just a stranger walking through. And then I kind of walked up and tapped and was like, hey, dude, it's me. And they were like, whoa. We didn't recognize you at all. Yeah. So it was much of a change.
But the Cockies are also great, too. I think they're pleated. Like, is it like a whole thing to like fit in as well as possible?
Well, he didn't really have much of a choice. He found a house that he was able to get into, and he took what was available to him there. So it was just, it could have easily have been, you know, overalls or something that happened to be what was in the closet. So he took what was there in a very sort of practical way.
Right, but I guess what I'm saying is in the writing and performance, if he stumbles into somebody's house and instead it's a pair of leather pants and a mesh shirt and a chainmail jacket.
Different type of
that's
movie.
That's a very different movie than Blue Button Down and, do you like my Dockers?
For sure. I mean, I think it was the intention that Dwight was trying to clean himself up because he knew the next point in his journey, he was going to revisit his past and reconnect with his sister, Sam. And he really was shocked by the fact that he once survived this encounter in the bathroom.
Right.
And now he was just sort of reeling from that. And then it's about undoing what he did. And the first thing he thinks of is his family. And so when he visits, it's just him trying to look presentable for the reunion with his sister.
I mean,
with pleats.
The whole thing is that in the movies, you often see somebody take a bullet in the shoulder and go, and keep going. Mm-hmm. And I think movies are very much the same way about emotional pain. And seeing something where it's like, oh, your family was wiped out when you were in your teens, and this has completely derailed the vision you had for your life. Mm-hmm. Where did that come from?
I'm not sure exactly. And it was about practicality. We knew we had to start on the beach and then reveal this past. And it was fun to sort of reverse engineer it because I knew I needed Macon with a big old beard with crumbs in it, living out of a husk of a sedan on the Delaware shore. I kind of reverse engineered it from there.
The other thing I'm wondering is about that sedan, which is almost a separate character.
Mm-hmm.
Did you fake the bullet holes or just shoot at it idly while standing back a safe distance?
Yeah, it was actually in pristine condition
when
we acquired it from my parents right before production. It was more of a battle than I thought it would be. But I claimed it. We would totally destroy it but immortalize it in the process, which we did. And that was a good friend of mine took it for a weekend and drilled holes. We placed tape reference marks where I needed that. We actually went through the forensics of the scene. It's actually the car that Dwight's parents were shot in.
Right, so you have a lot of shooting in Spall on the driver's side.
Exactly.
But not the remainder. It's not like somebody went up and down the vehicle. And I also like that, like a movie that's realistic about gunplay, where all it takes is one bullet if you know where to put it.
Right. Yeah, that was fun. It became this iconic, the visual motif of the 1990 Pontiac Bonneville. So that was... Once I saw that next to Dwight parked on the beach, I knew we had fully achieved the aesthetic of the film. Yeah.
Where did you shoot? I know Delaware, I know Virginia, I know that area, but where else? I mean, it's sort of everywhere USA at the same time.
Yeah, we did some pickups. So basically it was 4 days in Delaware, 2 days in Brooklyn at Fort Tilden on the Atlantic coast. That was doubling for Delaware, but it was easier to park a car and shoot locally in Brooklyn. That's where we're based out of. And then the rest was all Virginia except for one pickup scene. We couldn't afford to shoot in the triage area of a working hospital during production, so we picked that up in New Jersey January the following year.
Are you guys who worry a lot about permits or just go somewhere where you don't expect to run into people?
We tried to be legit with our permitting process and all of our SAG and union regulations, but we definitely...
cut a few corners here and there.
Exactly. And... for locations, we were smart enough on the onset to line most of the key locations up beforehand through friends and family. So there's a key night invasion sequence that takes place in the house I grew up in. Two of the other set pieces took place on a property called East 100 out of Charlottesville, Virginia, and there it's been in Macon's family for decades. So,
is that where the ultimate resolution takes place, at that old? Because that building has so much character and history to it. It looks like you know it doesn't look set dressed. It looks found.
It kind of, there was some set dressing done to it, but it did definitely have that very old character to it when we found it. That's called Forest Lodge, and my grandparents lived there, and my dad lived there for a while, and then also the house where Dwight's friend Ben, the military veteran Ben, lives was another house on that property that my great aunt AD Blair lived in. And so yeah, Jeremy, we knew that we had access to these locations, and so he wrote them into the script so that when we got there, it wasn't about trying to on the day reconfigure a script page to some place that we'd never been before, because the script was written exactly to, he walks from this room to this room to this room, knowing that that's where we would be filming it.
Are you a storyboarder? I mean, do you?
I am.
Yeah.
In the first 20 minutes of the film, the entire first act is almost shot for shot as I boarded the narrative. But yeah, as we were doing like a simultaneous Kickstarter campaign, trying to cast the movie, crew up, and all this, so production caught up to me, and my storyboards devolved from layered sort of Photoshop images to like just chicken scratch stick figures on
stick
the back
figure
of my
with
screen.
A gun, yeah,
yeah, pretty much. But it's important for me when I have the time, yes, to storyboard.
There is one great shot in the film, which, for fear of spoiling it, I won't go into it, but it is a great demonstration of the speed of sound,
yes,
versus the speed of objects that make that sound. Is that something you research? Is that something you think about? Because it's very different from what people are used to seeing cinematically, where action and after effect come so closely upon each other. What that great little pause is really, really
yeah.
great.
Well, it was baked into the script from the very beginning. I love the power of sound design, especially if you rely upon visuals and a lot of nonverbal communication in a story. Sound design is key to everything. And the scene in question is, I would say it's a bit traditional in its arc, but what we did was we infused this sort of blunt force reality and just grounded it and made it sloppy and brutal and, again, inconvenient. And so we embrace these little technical things you don't often see in movies and made it part of the scene. I think it's one of the most effective in the film.
You guys were on the festival circuit for a while to great acclaim, but one, Macon, is it weird to walk in there cleanly shaven and have everybody stare at you like, what, that guy?
Yeah, it's weird, it's exciting, it's overwhelming. We've said before, it's even a little embarrassing because it's been, I mean, I think we felt like we were proud of the movie that we made, especially considering the limited resources. I think we did what we set out to do, and we hoped that people would like it, and it feels good when people do like it. But a year of doing all of these festivals, including Toronto and Sundance and Canada, that was way outside the scope of what certainly I was expecting. I think mm-hmm. what Jeremy was expecting too. So it's you do start to feel a little, a little embarrassed.
Well, it's like you've finished a film and you've planted a flag on the hilltop that says we did it.
Yeah.
And then other people see that flag and like it and run it up a taller hill, and you're like, what are we doing up here? Is that correct?
That's a great way to say it, where I'm kind of like, I think it's good.
I was really happy this was done.
At all, and that, you know, Jeremy didn't go broke doing it. Yeah, but I mean, to get to go to the places we've gotten to go, I am, to be clear, not complaining. It is just sort of like a weird place to be in, to feel kind of like undeserving in a sort of way, but certainly I'm not going to complain.
There's the phrase quality problem, you know, oh, I've got just too much money. I think there's a phrase such as a quality neurosis, like, oh, I don't deserve to be here at Cannes.
If this is going to be,
and
yeah,
we spent, you know, the last 20 years, we started out with these aspirations and hopes and dreams, and they weren't quite dashed, but we had to cope with reality that we wouldn't premiere there, or our script wouldn't get funded, and over time, you know, I was becoming a little more jaded and a bit disgruntled. And again, not a charity case or a sob story, just I was going to have to redirect my career towards something else.
The life of art is tough, man. It is. Tough, you know, like, oh, I want to make something that reflects an aesthetic and a set of beliefs I have,
right,
and hope that somehow gets people to respond to it enough to pay me so I can live.
Right. And this was, again, I've always had to self-fund my films because I could not raise money. Was not worth money to the actuarial assessment people for international sales. And I was an unproven director. My last film was 6 years ago. I was rusty. We were just, you know, liabilities. And this was actually, I would say, it could easily have been a sign-off. Like, we were trying to make a movie that we felt represented us, but it was maybe our last film.
And if you're going to go out, you're going to go out how you want to.
Right. Well, because so much, like, the technology had evolved so much, things were finally lining up where I felt the stories we wanted to tell were accessible. But we were at the end of our window of opportunity. So I was like, well, let's at least, you know, buy one of these awesome cheap cameras and make a movie that we stand by. And at the very least, if we quit before we do this film, we will be failures. But if we quit after this film, it will be because, you know, we had to cope with reality and move on to other careers. But we'll at least have this movie, and either it's going to premiere at Sundance or Cannes or nowhere. And we'll have some kind of DVD or digital file nowadays, an archive of our experience and our collective journey that spanned almost 30 years. So we needed this for ourselves, and we made it for audiences, and all the other stuff is an awesome bonus.
Well, I mean, it's imperative you say, and we made it for audiences, because, you know, you can get a Polaroid for a lot less than 9 months of beard growing and all the money you had to raise. I'm kind of a little bit lapsed on the timeline. Did it premiere at Cannes or did it premiere at Toronto?
It premiered at Director's Fortnight in Cannes, yeah.
So when you get that call, I mean, whenever I write something where it's 1,000 words or 20,000 or whatever, I just stand there going, it's trash. Can't stand it. Can't even look at it. And that's not even a function of quality. It's just a function of having your eyes go over it so many times and living with it for so long and being conspicuously aware of its flaws. When you get that call, oh, gentlemen, Director's Fortnight, you have to run around banging on a pot with a spoon yelling Oklahoma for a little bit, right?
Oh, for sure. I was on the way to a corporate video job in Cleveland, Ohio. And I was we had already submitted to Sundance the previous year, and it was a two-hour assembly with a missing scene card, that hospital scene I mentioned. We didn't shoot it at that time. So basically, we had accepted our fate and actually, we'll go back to our day jobs, save up money. And we used Cannes as a deadline just to make it because we had stalled out completely. So we got back together for 4 weeks. My editor, Julia Block, came on board. And we were kind of pestering Fortnite because that's who we thought, the only chance we had. It was a total moonshot. But of the different selections, maybe Fortnite. Anyways, we inquired as to the date they notified.
It's like saying it's easier to get to the moon than Mars or Jupiter.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So we realized our post schedule was impossible, and they notified just 6 weeks before you premiere. So we were like, we can't really do this. When are you guys going to notify? Because if just for shits and giggles, if we get in, we have to hire a new post team. Anyways, we pestered them 3 times, and they would send back these cryptic, encouraging emails. And so we were just like a DVD on the pile. We had done some emailing, but there was no direct interface between me, Macon, or anyone in the program.
You didn't sit down and have a cup of tea with Thierry Frémaux or anything, right?
We were off the radar, and what's so great is that and it's almost dangerous, but it can happen. Like, you can be picked off the pile, and we were embraced because we were not a Sundance premiere. Sundance did us a huge favor by realizing we weren't ready to premiere. It was too loose. They could not program our film at the expense of others, so it was a gift from them. And then when Fortnite took us after our first solid cut was submitted, it was a mad dash to get it finished. And you talk about artists having to sit through it all. We had taken some time off between Sundance and the Fortnite submission, but in that time, you know, it was just less precious. So we sat back down to edit. We started chopping it mercilessly, and it became much tighter. And we cut out, I think, 16 minutes in like 2 days. It was great. So to get it finished in time, we had to split it off into reels and start sound designing and sound editing while we were cutting picture. It was a mess. and we had no time to assess what we were doing. We locked picture, but the finishing was so sweet, and the sound design and the color correction and the score came together. But no one had seen the movie, including myself or Macon, until the premiere. So we had to upload files to Paris to our international sales agents in the lab there. So it was just like, when we sat down, we didn't have that occurrence where it was like, oh, we only saw the flaws and we'd seen it five times. We never quality controlled this movie. We were just shocked and astonished that we made a movie, and we were in the director's Fortnight Theater with 800 people, and Dwight's character was just winning them over. So it was, from then on, it was just a fairy tale.
Totally.
I mean, when I look at Dwight, I can't help but think of like Dustin Hoffman in Straw Dogs. You know? Yeah. You know, like the whole thing of, oh, the last person you would want to have face the circumstances is the first person who has to step up.
Yeah.
When you're sitting in the theater and Dwight does something awful with, which is eyes and face and kind demeanor you do not expect, and you hear the audience go, does that tingling sensation tell you it's working, to paraphrase a dandruff commercial? Like, have you sat in the theater while the movie plays and heard people respond to it?
That's exactly what it was. I mean, like, the day of the premiere, you know, again, like, we had gotten in, so we felt like we had done something right somewhere along the line, and we felt good about it, but nonetheless, it hadn't played with an audience, and so we didn't really know what to expect. And just speaking for myself, that day, I was a complete ball of nerves. Like, I couldn't eat anything. I was just really wound up. And for the first 10 or 15 minutes of the movie, I was just sort of, like, gripping the handrests of my seat. And then at a certain point, there are a couple of those left turn kind of surprising moments, and we were getting the reaction that we had intended, which was gasps and kind of anxious, uneasy laughter. And then a little bit further on, there's another moment, and then they're applauding and they're cheering. And then at, you know, about halfway through the movie, I finally allowed myself to relax and was like, oh shit, I think we might have actually won
them
over.
They seem to get it.
They seem to get it. And especially with, you know, we weren't sure about like the colloquialisms, and it's like, it's a very American movie, and this is, and it's showing up there with French subtitles, and like, are the turns of phrase and just the point of it, is this even going to connect at all? And in fact, it did. And they really responded with a great deal of enthusiasm, and so that was the first sort of indication that we had maybe done our job.
Jeremy, what did you shoot on? What camera specifically did you use?
Well, it was a Canon C300, and it had just come out, and I was doing a lot of corporate videos, and I just shot three other films the previous summer on the Arri Alexa, which is, you know, one of the best cameras ever made.
Top of the line, yeah.
But it was a little too big and cumbersome for us to fully utilize, and I realized, you know, I'm going to step back from that whole the hang-up of getting the most pixels and dynamic range from a camera, and all these tech specs, and I'm going to own the camera, and I'm going to use it whenever I want to, on a whim, on the shoot, whatever it was. Like, I didn't want layers of approval or to impact the budget. I wanted to own the camera and just empower myself to capture images whenever I needed to. And it was great. I mean, it was a lesson in using a more mobile camera that was very sensitive to light and allowed us to move so fast with a little 5-foot camera slider. Not a lot of dolly track and big dollies were used, only occasionally, but we could move lightning fast. And I have this problem with movies when it's like you'll do an establishing shot at dusk and then you'll cheat the rest. We were getting shots that were like, it's imperative for me for atmosphere, like this has to be a dawn scene. We are moving so fast we could actually shoot like 6 or 8 setups in like 24-30 minutes running around with this camera having plotted it all out, and it worked out great because I wanted to have that atmosphere native to the script and the story and not have to rely on cutaways and establishing shots.
You can also take advantage of accidents, too. Like, at the end, all the fallen trees and everything like that was not originally in the script, but we were on a location scout, and a storm came through, knocked all these trees over, and Jeremy owned the camera, had it in his car, and was able to just... That's, like, production value that we couldn't afford. You can't We couldn't get that.
No,
but it was
I hear
there.
That. It's just that when I hear the phrase production value, I think of a kid yelling it in Super 8.
Yeah.
But the trees were all knocked down. They were already there, and it would have cost you a bunch of boom, blasted heath in one shot.
Well, he just had the sort of, like, instinctive, like, oh, wait a minute, this fits in thematically to the story week, and we have the ability to capture it right now without having to go rent a camera or fill out an invoice. We can just take it out of the trunk of the car and get the shots, and sure enough, that ended up in the actual cut of the movie. So it was just like a freedom to be able to do that.
Macon, I mean, this is a question I ask. I mean, I know Mr. Saulnier is right here, but is it a little bit tougher for you as an actor to argue with the director about the point of a scene when he's also the writer? I.e., you can't say, I feel like the writer was going for this when the director is, in fact, the writer? Or did that happen rarely? Is it really more collaborative than all of that?
It happened very rarely. It happened never on set. If it happened at all, it was in the months leading up to it when we would, I guess you would call it like a workshopping period where there was like back and forth about where the script was going. But I have complete faith in Jeremy's storytelling ability. So it was only if something like didn't feel, if it didn't gel in my mind, but we could always talk it out and arrive at a consensus. And more often than not, I would just listen to his sort of explanation about how it was going to look in the finished version, and I would think about it and be like, yeah, actually, that does make sense, and we can go with that. So maybe a little bit of back and forth, but by the time we got on set, we had totally gone over all of that, and we were completely on the same page, and we were able to just focus on photographing stuff and not debating meaning and intention and things like that.
Yeah, there was definitely some early exchanges in negotiations as far as Dwight's character, and that, I embraced that and I helped it. Actually, that first scene in the house where Dwight is inhabiting the space and it's not his own, that's actually Macon's idea, and he really advocates for his characters, and Macon's a writer too, so he understands story on that level and he approaches characters from that level. So when on set, I needed to lean on someone. I could lean on Macon not only to maintain the integrity of his character and be real and truthful in the moment, but he knew the whole story arc backwards and forwards, and he helped shape it. So it was, he's a key collaborator and doesn't get all the credit he deserves, but, you know, because I'm a glory hound and I need those three big credits.
So noted. We'll pass on some of the credit to Mr. Blair. You guys mentioned Johnny Handsome, which is a great Walter Hill revenge flick where, you know, in becoming a killer, the protagonist is literally and figuratively transformed. We talked about Straw Dogs. What are, like, the revenge films you think about when you think about what you want to celebrate and upend a little bit in the subgenre?
I wasn't really referring to specific revenge scenarios, but I loved the world of No Country for Old Men. I love that there's so much badassery there.
But it's such a flat, quotidian world.
Absolutely. And I initially pitched the film as it's No Country for Old Men with an idiot at the helm. You know, this is not your everyday Vietnam vet doing this sort of thing. But, Macon, what do you have to say?
I don't know if it's a revenge movie, but there was something about, I think we've, at least for me, there was something about Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
And the way that when it does finally erupt into bloodshed, it is not a cool, he has two guns, jumping over the hood of a car, running from a fireball type of slick action scenario. It's very messy. It's very awkward. It's very ugly.
It's shouty.
It's weird. People get shot. They don't immediately die. They continue to kind of crab crawl down the hallway mm-hmm. after you. It takes a lot of effort and mess. And I think that sort of approach to those kinds of genre elements, like, you know, people getting killed, that's going to happen in a revenge movie, that's a given, but how you approach it, I think it's a little closer to that type of sort of gritty 70s style maybe.
And Michael Mann too, just that 80s aesthetic, what he did with
Don't
Thief.
Build It, Find It.
Yeah.
That being a big part of a Mann thing. I mean, there are no sets in Heat, right? It's all found location.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And Thief, I love how he treated the break-ins, you know, they were so not sensational. They were so pragmatic and they seemed almost mundane.
It's like car mechanics just like working on
them. Yeah, a really hot torch and that's it. And it's like a 5-minute scene just like, we're just going to make this real hot. And then we're gonna, but it wasn't like, you know, rappelling down
black side. Turtleneck.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was
Ocean's 11.
Gliding like through a laser beams. Yeah.
It just seemed like it had so much more authenticity to it. And I love that, where it's like, let's really ground Blue Ruin in that sort of thing, where it's not, I mean, it's again, it's a thriller, and it's action packed, and it has blood and guts, but like, it's much more fun to approach it from this very grounded perspective and see, like, you know, what the audience would do in that situation. And that's how they relate to Dwight, is he's doing things that normal humans would do, like retreat.
And as normal humans would do them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've been talking with Jeremy Saulnier and Macon Blair of Blue Ruin, which opens this Friday in Austin, Texas, and Los Angeles, courtesy of Radius TWC Pictures. And you can find more information about the film online at Blue Ruin Movie on Twitter. Gentlemen, thank you very kindly for joining us.
Thank you, James. It was great to be here.
Look forward to talking to you cats about your next movie.
Likewise.
Until next time, this is The Lunch Podcast. I'm your regular host, James Rocky. And between now and the next time you tune in, go to the movies with your friends, have a meal afterwards, and talk about it. It's a good thing.